Do you ever feel stuck, like you're living your life on autopilot? Are you ready to shift into high gear and reach the success you so richly deserve? Welcome to the Play Big Movement podcast. I am your host, Sharon Lecter, entrepreneur, business strategist, and best-selling author. Playing big is not about settling for good enough or being comfortable. It is about reaching your highest potential and achieving your greatest success. Join me in my Play Big movement as I interview top experts in business, money, and entrepreneurship, all ready to serve you and to help you play big, be number one in your field, live your legacy, and create maximum impact. Hello, everyone. I'm very excited today because my guest is not just somebody that I really look up to and appreciate, but he's a dear friend, and we've been known each other for many years. So you see him in the picture. Say hi to Don Green. He is the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation and a real gift to all who knows him. And it's really an incredible opportunity for him to share with us today, because I want you to know more about Don. You know about Napoleon Hill, you know about the foundation, but Don has chosen to dedicate himself to reinvigorating the teachings of Napoleon Hill after an incredibly successful professional career of his own as a banker. So Don, welcome. I'm so excited you could be with me today.
Sharon, it's my pleasure.
Well, I want you to share with the folks that are watching a little bit about your story. And I know you started in a very modest beginning. So tell your story so that they can get to know Don from beginning to end here.
Well, I was born in Southwest Virginia, and my parents both went to the seventh grade. They were both of them products of the Great Depression. Mom was one of 16 children. My dad was one of 12. And I remember asking my mother one time, why did you and daddy go to the seventh grade? And she said, you little smart aleck, said, the teacher had only went to the seventh grade. Said the closest high school was 10 or 12 miles away, and they didn't have school buses. And so they went to work. At 13, 14 years old, the men went to work in the coal mines. At, I think back then the wages was about $2 a day. And that's how they got started. You know, we didn't have the government programs, but they, some things they had. They had hard work, honesty. They had their faith. And something else, which I appreciate more every day, was they had gratitude. The neighbors helped each other. They helped each other out. You know, they traded eggs for milk because it raised on a farm, gardens and so forth. And they didn't go get food stamps. They didn't get government checks. They simply survived and hard work. And then complaints to her would get answered by hard work never kill nobody, and it's not going to kill you. So so that we learned from them. But they did value education. They were so proud when their children, these five of us, went to high school. You would think that, we'd been elected president or something like that, because here they went to the seventh grade, of course, and some of us went on to college, and all of us got some, but some graduated and whatever, got trades. So, every day, I'm reminded of things that they taught us. I mean, just like I know the story. She was close to 90, and one of her neighbors went to prison for drugs. And when she got out, she knew he was coming out. She baked him a cake and put it on his porch for him, and rather than shunning him. And she was continuously taking the family stuff out of her garden, be it peppers or lettuce or beans or corn or whatever. And that's who she was. She didn't have a tremendous lot of money, though she was successful. And she lived alone for 20 years after my dad died. But the people I heard from was just remarkable that she had a little log book she called it. She would call you, Sharon. She'd say, now, Sharon, have you taken your medicine? Now, when is it you go back to the doctor, Sharon? Now, Sharon, do you have someone to take you? Would you like me to take you? Because most of the women didn't drive. Matter of fact, in my mother's family, she's the only girl that ever learned to drive. And they all of them lived. She had one sister, 98, one 96, one 95. They just never drove back then. And fact is, my dad taught my mother how to drive after she had she had five kids, and he taught her to drive, and she was so proud of that that she could drive and take people to the doctor or go to the nursing home and so forth. So I think I got a little bit of the traits out from them that the X2035, I hear it over and over and over. It's more blessed to give than receive, and sometimes I think that kind of gets
Well, and you impacted your entire community with an entire career as a banker, and you could have easily retired and stayed there in your small in that community forever, but you saw something bigger. Of course, the name of this podcast is the Play Big Movement, and so I love it because you're a perfect example of someone you've created. You created your own personal legacy with the number of people that you helped and served as a banker. And then you saw this opportunity and you reached out and sought after it. So tell us a little bit about that transition from being a banker. Now, I often say in public accounting, I saw how companies did it right, and I saw an equal number of companies who did it wrong. And you and I have had this conversation because as a banker, you saw the same thing. You saw people who knew how to build wealth and a lot of people who didn't know how to build wealth. But what was that triggering thing to move from this incredibly great career to stepping into the unknown world of entrepreneurship with the Napoleon Hill Foundation?
Well, I did a lot of entrepreneurship when I was growing up, from having a zoo to numerous things that we won't get into, but just numerous things I did. And initially, I will admit, it was to make money, because I thought a gold Rolex and a black Mercedes and $1 million is success. But that's when you're 18 years old, 20 years old, you're thinking those things. You measure success by money. But as you get along, you remember what your family taught you and so forth. And I think I did a posting that said, if you're not satisfied with what you got, you're not going to be happy with when you get more. And not getting into religion, but as I've heard said, was if you're not satisfied with what God give you, why would you expect God to give you more? You know, which I think is pretty profound. So I think being content, I remember W. Clement Stone, he used to say we had to have internal dissatisfaction, meaning that we're satisfied, but we can see more. We can use our minds to create more. And I know working for 75 cents in a coal mine was about 3 foot high one summer, pulling mining steel out, it would be child labor laws, it'd get locked up today. But something come to me that said, you know, if I work with my hands all my life, I'll make a living. But if I can use my mind, I can really do well. And the banking was, I love banking. I was a bank president for 20 years. And I can tell you, I never foreclosed on a house loan I made in the 20 years. Because I simply, not that people didn't get in trouble, but if it's so bad that there was no way out, there's a divorce or whatever, I would give them some time to sell it, because at a foreclosure, that's the worst thing can happen, because there's no equity. I mean, people show up looking for a bargain. And so I would talk to them and work with them and tell them I was on their side. And it worked. And I still have people come up to, just recently I had this lady come up to me and she said, you know, Don, I never will forget, said when me and my husband come in here apply for a loan, said he told me, said, I don't know why you're dragging me down here. There's no way that banker's going to loan us money to buy that little house that you're wanting. And, of course, it's been redone now, and I go back and one of my sisters, and it don't even look like the same house, because they redid it and they built additions onto it and so forth. But them are good stories, you know. It gives you a good feeling to whether you help a kid go to school or you help somebody out and so on. I'm approached by people all the time that I was just doing my job, I thought, and helping them out. But you asked about the transition. I remember the trustees. Of course, I was a trustee, and they asked me, said, the other guy, he had got too old, he couldn't travel, whatever, and it was obvious they needed someone, and they wanted, I didn't apply for the job. And they said, I was the obvious one because I knew the material. But Charlie Johnson, who you met, Dr. Johnson, he's Napoleon's nephew. Napoleon saved the medical school. He's a part-time practicing cardiologist. I believe he's 84, but still refers to him as Uncle Knapp. Our work, he mentions over and over. He said, boy, Uncle Knapp would be proud of what you guys are doing. And he asked me, said, now you've been banking, and said, now this is books. I said, Charlie, I love books. And I said, it's all about business and taking care of people. And I said, the first day that you guys say, if I take the job, the first day you say I'm not doing a job, I won't embarrass you. Just tell me and I'll leave and there will be no hard feelings. And so it's been absolutely wonderful. I mean, yesterday I had put this up, but here's a little book that was printed in Vietnam. That's Ho Chi Minh City. And we've done a dozen of their books over, including your Think and Grow Rich for Women. Isn't that a long ways from the Vietnam War? We think we've had positive effect. For example, on your book, Think and Grow Rich for Women, the first foreign lesson I did was in Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Yeah, I've got a copy of that here too, but that was the first place.
Yeah, I was so proud of that. So exciting. The place where women need it the most.
Well, I think, Sharon, you had a part in it, because just recently in the news, they can now drive cars. I mean, that's a big deal if all your life you've not been able to drive a car and your simple reason you're a female and you couldn't drive. And they even let them go to sporting events. I mean, you know, what's going to happen next? I mean, there's hope for the world when we can communicate, because people can see that there's a different lifestyle out there than what they've been taught all this time. So with all the communications things out there today, it's easier for people to know what's going on. They read your stories about successful women. And somewhere along the line, even if they're slow, something should click and say, well, you know, maybe I can do something too. Because when people, once they have hope, there's no limit to what they can accomplish. No limit. In fact, I had a little success magazine that Hill did. He called it Inspiration. But he had on the front of it, the only limitations we have are those we put in our own mind. He said that in 1931 on the cover. That's probably been used a few million times since then. So,
and that was the whole basis of the messaging that he has in Outwitting the Devil, which, of course, I was honored enough. You called me one day to have me look at that manuscript. But that was, you know, the Outwitting the Devil is it the man-made devil or is it the, you know, the real one? And it's really we create obstacles for ourselves based on fear that we have.
Well, sure. I don't want to brag or anything, but when I had that manuscript and I finally talked to trustees, the wives didn't want it done because of the religious, the thing using the word devil and so forth. And I finally talked Charlie into it. His wife was a doctor also. She had passed away. She took up for Napoleon's wife, who has also passed away. And so I told him, Charlie, we're denying a good message. Believe me, I've read the book. And I don't mean to brag or anything, but there's literally thousands and thousands of people I could have got to help promote that book. And you was the first person I asked. You was the first person. So, and yours happens to be the...
Yay, there's the original one. Yep.
We printed the first page in that thing. Of course, you can see there what it is now. I insist on the publisher.
So I want everybody to look at this, because you'll see it's typed on a manual typewriter, but you'll see this handwritten notes from Napoleon Hill. That's why I felt like I was in his presence as I'm looking through the manuscript, because he's made manual annotations in there. So it was so cool to have that opportunity.
I do not know how many countries it's in. Because like when you do Hispanic, you know, it's 30, 40 countries. But it's in, because I just got one, it's in 37 different languages. So how many countries that cover, I only know. And, of course, we know what the sales are on the thing. It's dealing with the fear of a man-made devil.
Well, I have to confess, John, I'm going to confess to you, when you first sent it to me, I got a little like, oh, my gosh, Outwitting the Devil, do I need negativity? And in fact, my daughter, who's a minister, she says, Mom, I need to pray over you. And I ran over to the beach in San Diego by myself, turned off my phone, and sat down to read the manuscript. And within a couple of hours, I knew the manuscript had to get out. But I have to confess, when you first sent it to me, I was like, oh my goodness, do I want to do this? Then I read it and I thought, whoa, what an incredible opportunity.
I think some of the trustees felt that way, but they hadn't read it. I've read it, you know, the material that I saw it, I thought, he's covering things. There's nothing that prevents someone from being successful. It's fear. And most of them are created. They're created in our mind, about 99% of them. And the ones that's not, we can figure out an answer to it. But if we build that negativity up in our mind, there's no way we can be successful, because you and I know that we can't hold positive thoughts and negative thoughts at the same time. And the negative thoughts, they give your it gives strength to our own self. The more you think on, the stronger they get, and they take over. So it's an important subject, and like I said, the material like this is, it will be as popular in 40 years as it is from now. I mean, Hill's books, be it Russia. I mean, some of the countries like Armenia and Macedonia, some of them, it's not known that well, or wasn't well 50 years ago. It didn't exist, but I haven't counted them recently, but the number of foreign publishers we have, it's probably approaching 400 different ones. I do know, because J.B. Hill, our trustee, Hill's grandson, he adopted a couple of children from Russia, and he asked me one day, said, how many books we got? I said, gosh, J.B., I didn't run them all down, but I do keep a list of publishers. I said, we have 18 different Russian publishers. And I said, so, people are reading the books all over the world. And of course, in this one, the first foreign contract, you remember, it was, and on that one, that was in China. And I mean, it's in Estonia, Vietnam, it's in Korea. I mean, you name it, it's about Ben Lassen's, and it'll eventually get into even all the other smaller countries.
And part of us, bringing that out, we all know what happened to the economy in 2008, 2009. And we really wanted to reinvigorate the teachings of Hill for the younger generation, because many of them hadn't been introduced to Hill. And I think with this book, we talk, the name of this podcast is the Play Big Movement. And we realized, in order to really make a big impact on that younger generation, we needed something that was a little in your face, a little eye opener. And I think it's worked on. I think we've had a tremendous amount of acceptance and excitement from the younger generation related to Outwitting the Devil, don't you think?
Oh, yes. They enjoy the material. That's the reason, like with the scholars, we have 20 Napoleon Hill scholars, and they're the brightest of the brightest on campus. And they will do about approximately 20 presentations a semester. And choosing to talk on some of the topics. And the response I've got is unbelievable. They went to places like the job under the guidance of the counselor, or teaches a course, she's a psychologist, and she's a guidance counselor on campus. But I got responses. One day I went into the restaurant, and the judge was in our domestic court judge, and it happened to be Dr. Smitty's, our chancellor's daughter. And she said, "Oh, Don, I wanted to tell you," she said, "those kids that we have in court," said, "they love listening to the students." She said, "us older people can try to guide them, and they shut us down." But she said, when they were talking about people that was not much, a few years older than them, said they really listened. And they go to the job corps, they go to domestic court, they go to even grade schools, high schools, and the college. And, yeah, and the response is real good, because they're closer to their age group, and so they listen to them, and it's amazing response we get from them. It's just amazing. I can tell you a story about my friends who's an entrepreneur, and he took my class at college, and talked to him, and one day I told him about buying a second little store. I said, "Man, woman's getting divorced." I said, $75,000. He said, "I think I got $75,000. He said, "I loaned it to you." He said, "I think you're crazy." I loaned it to him. But he sold out about probably 10 years ago. He sold out for $45
million. Wow. And he told me, that's a nice return on investment, huh?
Well, yeah. His first day, he took in $3.20. He said, "Never would forget it." But one day we was going to lunch, and the guy was coming out of the restaurant who I did not know. I knew his face, but I was not business acquainted with. And of course, Wendell, he told me later that the guy's wife worked for him. And he asked him if he ever got a job. And this is that period of time when you was talking about. And he said, "Do you ever get you a job?" And he said, "No." He said, "Where have you been?" He said, "There's no use of going. Nobody's hiring." So, you know, he done made up his mind. He's not going to get no job. You know, he's going to let fear take over. So, you know, it's not going to happen. And that can happen. And of course, you and I know that people can do the best in the worst of times. And some people are not going to do good in the best of times because it's in their mindset. And that same way within the community they live in, saying there's no opportunities because I'm a rural area. You know, there's just not no good jobs, and go on and on and on. And they've done convinced ourselves, you know. I've said over and over, I used a book when I was teaching. It's "What Do We Say When We Talk to Ourselves?" And someone can walk up and tell you, "By the way, you look very nice today." But someone could tell you that, "Sharon, you don't look good for an interview." And then it might bother you for a few minutes, and you look yourself in the audience. You know. But when Sharon says to Sharon, "You know, I just don't look right for an interview," then you're doomed, because we tend to believe our self-talk, and it's the most important conversation we'll ever have in our life. Is when we talk to ourselves, whether it's good conversation or bad conversation. It's just extremely important.
I hope you all are listening to Don, because he's just been given so many little nuggets of incredible stuff. I mean, if you're not satisfied with what you have, what makes you think you're going to be satisfied with more? I mean, I just love that. And I love this one. You know, you have to choose. You're going to work with your hands, or you're going to work with your mind. And that's all about intellectual property and what we do today, and solving problems and serving needs, and knowing that. I love that one, because that's all about creativity, innovation, solving problems. Sure. And then, I love it.
Sharon, you're a good example. When my wife, you know, I was married 54 years, passed away, but we sold the bank while she was still healthy. And she volunteered. She never helped down a regular job per se, but she volunteered. And we was out eating one night, and I'm sitting at a table with her. These four ladies in a table next to her, and they're carrying on a conversation. I'm not paying anything at all. In fact, as I remember now, I thought of something, and I was writing a note out. I always keep a pencil on a 3x5 card. I was writing notes. And one of the ladies said, "Well, Phil, I know they sold Don's bank." Said, "What's he working at now?" And she said, "Let me tell you about Don. He's never worked at nothing." And she said, "What do you mean?" He says, "He always gets somebody else to do it." And I think that's part of it. I said, in the office, they wouldn't let me hang a picture, you know, and just like I'm using Lana to help me on this tech stuff, you know, I can use my iPhone and I can do a little stuff, but I can't devote all my time to it. If I got somebody that's 100 times better than I am, I can think of things, you know, my mind stays busy creating things, turning out some new books and thinking of interviews or audios I got and stuff that I can develop. Like, I've got the American Key to Riches. I looked at the contract, and a contract with a publisher, and it's been out since 1945. It was for paperback. Why the world they put paperback? So the original book was a hardcover, and so I got a publisher that paid me well. It's going to be a nice hardcover, and it's going to be in the airport bookstore in about May or June. And just keep thinking of things, because now, like, I know we do Hell Written the Devil, that's paperback. But if you're thinking about getting a student a good book for graduation, which is nothing better, wouldn't you want to give them a nice hardcover? I mean, or if you want one to stick in your library collection, you want a nice hardcover book. It's just something about it being permanent and something that you want to hold on to. We know this. The paperbacks is important because the publishers are trying to put them out cheaper and they're easier to print and be printed on demand, so forth. So it has its advantage. But if I'm telling someone to buy a book, I wouldn't think about telling, go out and buy you a paperback to give that kid that spent 4 years going to college. You know, it doesn't send a very good message for only $4 or $5 difference. You can give a nice hardcover book that most of them will cherish.
Well, I just love it. And you just continue to sharing, because that's, you know, what John was just talking about, you know, you hear things like time management but really applying your mind and knowing that you assign the time that you're going to spend on the things that you can create the greatest value from and want to delegate it or find other people who are strong, whose talents are strong where you're weak. And that's something we talk about over and over again. And that's, you know, again, when you want to play big, you have to surround yourself with people that will do those things so that you can focus on what can help drive their business forward in a big way. And I just want to also remind everybody about what you talked about. And you want to do your best in the worst of times, right? Not the worst in the best of times. And that's really training yourself to be able to spot opportunities and do that by studying and reading. And, you know, the whole basis of Napoleon Hill's work is to train your mind on how to start spotting those opportunities to create a foundation of success. Right, Don?
Yes, that's right. I'll tell you a little story. I used to attend, you know, he was connected to Norman Vincent Peale, and we have some of his audios and so forth. I attended a guidepost function in downtown Cleveland, and I remember, and I was an invited guest. It just had Don Green, Wise, Virginia. At the table, this lady asked me, she said, and someone was speaking, and which I didn't want to call a conversation. She said, "Where is Wise, Virginia?" I said, "In the Appalachian Mountains." She comes back and says, "Y'all have a lot of poor people, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And then she comes back and says, "Won't somebody do something to help them poor people?" So I didn't react and get mad or anything, but I thought, "Lady, I have got an answer for you. First, we have a break." I said, "Ma'am, let me tell you something. I'm going to tell you more in a couple minutes that you're going to learn. I've been to guideposts in Palm Springs. I've been to one in California. I've attended a lot of them, and I love those people. But here's what I'm going to tell you. What you asked me, yes, we have poor people. But today a limo picked me up, Cleveland, down as we cut downtown. I just happened to look out the window, and I saw probably 15, 20 or more people under the bridge. And I said, they're homeless. I said, now I want to tell you a little about history. I have been to Cleveland before. I said, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame here for one thing, but also I visited John D. Rockefeller's cemetery. I said, he's got a statue. It looks like a Washington Monument. It's not that high, but it's big. I said, he was considered, founded Standard Oil. I said, considering one of the richest people in the world. And said, what I'm going to tell you is, and this is what I want you to remember, and I don't want you to get mad at me or anything, but I said, both poverty and riches spring from our minds. We have rich people. I said, I got friends that sold out for $1 billion in the coal business. I said, also, yep. But I said, I think we're so small. I've never heard tell no one being homeless. I've never seen nobody under a bridge or anything like that. I think we're a close enough community that someone, a church or someone, would be talking about them. But I said, the lesson is simply this. Both poverty and riches is in our mind. And I said, you got rich people in the poorest place on earth, and you got poor people in the richest place on earth. I said, I used to get asked that when I was transferred to Indianapolis. A guy said, y'all from your hillbilly said, y'all got a lot of poor people. I said, guys, 5 miles from where we're sitting out here, I come by them every day. These guys live out there in pasteboard boxes. So it happens to everywhere. You know, in a nice part of San Diego, you know, it's out there, they got whole blocks of homeless people living on the streets. And, you know, and you got wealth within. Well, you saw it, I mean, over and over again. So it's how we use our mind, either negative or positive. And there's a lot of people think they got to keep going where the grass is greener. The grass is greener right where you are if you use your mind.
The grass is greener right where you are, exactly. Yeah. And that's training yourself on how to spot those opportunities and then taking advantage of them. And, you know, I think one of the things that Hill teaches and certainly talks when he was originally out there practically penniless going to try and find a publisher, he used his last few dollars to make sure he was dressed to the nines and looked successful so he could play, you know, basically come across as playing big. And as a result, we have Think and Grow Rich and the incredible dynasty of legacy work that he left behind him that we're now continuing to support continue to share around the globe.
I taught the class for 12 years and they would send me a check. I taught it the night when I was a bank president. I just wanted the material and had this cute little girl sit on the front row. Of course, this is in the fall and she was dressed like she's going to the beach. And when I was covering dress, personality, and she says, "Well, Professor Green," said, "don't look at me like if you know what you're doing, it wouldn't matter what you were and if you know your job." I said, "Let me ask you something. if there's a boy that you've been wanting to date for a year and he calls you for a date, are you going to clean up? Yeah, of course I'm going to. I said, why? Well, I want to make a good impression on it. I said, why wouldn't you dress for an employer to be? I said, I'm a bank president. I'm prejudiced as all get out. But if I've got a job open and I've got 10 young ladies comes in and apply for a job, and there's one of them, she's got her hair fixed nice like you have today, and she's dressed proper, everything else being considered, because she told me, I really want this job. I'm going to put my best person out there. I've took time to clean up and present myself, and I respect you. I said, when I was working in the finance business, I think I was making maybe as much as $75 a week. I wanted the suit. And so I asked around. I was in town where Eastman Kodak was, and I asked people, where'd them guys buy their clothes? And they said, Sobel's. It was a Jewish men's store, and I think it must have been open for 80 or 90 years. So I walked in there one day, and they told me I could make monthly payments on one they custom fitted for, which I couldn't afford. But they had a sign up. I'll never forget it. They had a sign up behind the cash register. It said, if you want to be a success, first dress the part. And if that don't send a signal, I don't know what does. You might be a bum when you're worth a few $1 billion to get by with, but you just send a message. I read a study, and I can never remember where it's USC or UCLA. They did a study with small kids. I'm talking about small kindergarten kids. And they found that the teachers treated the children that was dressed better than ones that didn't. Like I told that girl, she said it didn't seem to be fair. I said, that's another thing you need to learn. Life's not fair. We have to deal with reality. If people are going to treat you better if you're dressed proper, why would you not dress proper? I said, you'll come here getting a seat in a restaurant if you're out there waiting and they don't know where you are. You're more likely to get picked on to get a seat if you're dressed proper than you just come in off the street like you slept in a garbage truck. I mean, it's just crazy not to present yourself with your, as they say, best foot forward. You're just robbing yourself of opportunity, and that's all.
Absolutely. And that's all part, today in today's society with the younger generation, we get a lot of challenge about that. And so I would rather show up showing that I took the time to want to present myself well than to show up disheveled. And so I leave that to you as an audience to determine if your trademark is you wear a black t-shirt and black jeans and that's who you are and that's who you want to stay, that's your choice. But when you're not in control, all right, so Steve Jobs, he was in control. He could establish his personal brand. But while you're still looking to support yourself through becoming an employee, or whether you're looking to you may own your own business, but you want to collaborate and do something with other companies. I don't think that Don would have been as receptive to getting to know me if I was in a, dressed shabbily and not respectful of who I am and showed respect to you, Don. And so that when you want to collaborate, you want to do business with someone else, you respect them by showing up with the intent that you have prepared and you want to make a good impression.
Well, it's just not thinking to be otherwise. I mean, because it's competitive. It's competitive out there. It's competitive. But also we need to be given a chance. And that's one way to get the chance. Even if you do all that, all it does is an opportunity. I said, I'm on the Board of Trustees, University of Virginia, and have been for probably 20 years. I'm president of the Foundation Board, which is a fundraising part of the college. And by the way, our students graduated with the second lowest debt load of any four-year college in the United States last year. So we've raised a lot of money in a poverty-stricken area. But it's not graduation. It's commencement. I mean, I've got a new beginning when you get that degree. It's not your graduation. That means you're final. It's really a commencement. I'm off to a new beginning. I'm going to take what I've learned and I'm going to put used to it, because it's like our material. I know we got people go over and over and over to seminars, what have you. But the action part of it is the value of it is what's in that you can use in your life to get ahead, not just being able to recite all the principles and what have you. But as Mr. Stone said, read that thing and say, where can I apply this in my life?
Exactly.
And we're the only one can answer those questions. Someone can answer them for us. But it's extremely important. It's what we do with it. You know, we say he originated the term "just do it," which Nike uses, but I've got them in my desk back there. He did little pins for his employees, white with a little red letter on it, and it clipped on their, like on their lapel, and didn't have a secret, just bent down a little metal thing on it, and it said three words, "just do it." And he'd often tell us that with the board meeting, we'd be discussing something. He said, "Well, just do it." You know, you can talk things to death, but somewhere along the line, you've got to start, even if you don't know all the answers.
That's right. Take action. That passion plus talent times association times action. So as we start to bring this interview to a close, Don, I want to make sure people know how to find the Napoleon Hill Foundation. So share a little bit about how people can find you.
Our website is naphill.org. And we got the websites, the Facebook and Instagram, all the other stuff. And we're trying to do what the trustees in 62, when they formed a nonprofit, did. It's a very simple mission: just make the world a better place in which to live. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of it.
Yes, you are. And under your leadership, you're making a huge impact.
It's an absolute pleasure. I wake up in the morning and I say, God, there's somebody out there I can make a difference today. And sometimes it's a simple thing and sometimes it's not. But there's always a change if we're, I call it passion with gratitude. It takes passion to get results. And if we're in our, if we're really thinking is we're going to give gratitude for what we've been blessed with. And I think it's just that simple, because I think you have to have passion. I mean, I travel quite a bit, probably more than I should. But, you know, I'm within 5 minutes of my home to the campus. I'll catch myself, you know, at maybe 7 or 8 o'clock when I'd have something on my mind. And I'll run in here and work an hour or so, and ain't nobody even knows it. You know, nobody but me. But it's because I enjoy doing it. You know,
that's right. You said you and I have talked about this before. We don't look at it as work. We look at it, you know, when we look at it as work, then we probably shouldn't be doing it.
No, and I said, was if you can't learn to love what you're doing, you need to be doing something else. Mm-hmm. I admire people that does any kind of job. If they've got mechanical ability, you know, they can repair cars or they fix lawnmowers, or they can. There's no job that's not important, but you have to find something that you have a passion for. And you call it burnout. I had a guy sent me a thing today, and he showed, he, like, I didn't count him, but he must have been on 25 different jobs, and something's wrong. And now, of course, if each one of them was an increase, that's fine. But he never stayed in one place long enough to develop anything, you know, constantly. And it's so many people, they don't like what they're doing, yet they chose what they're doing. They got nobody to blame themselves. You know, it's like not getting a further education. People, I saw him interview a guy that shut down a defense plane. It was Raytheon years ago, but I always remember it. This guy said, and of course they lost their contract. And this guy said, can you believe I've worked for this company 20 years and this is what they done to me? I'm thinking, buddy, in 20 years you could have got a PhD and anything out there. You know, you should work on yourself as hard as you're working on your job. You know, I think the time away from a job defines you as much as what it is on the job. Because if you're not reading and listening to audio tapes and associating with people that you can learn from, then how can you expect to grow? I mean, you know, you can do, I know the guy on the PepsiCo bottling company, someone asked him, said, George, said, there's a guy working there for a number of years, and said, he's still not making nothing. He said, well, he's doing the same job he's always done. I mean, in other words, he never grew nothing. He never took on additional responsibilities. And, of course, they some people don't want to take on responsibility. They basically develop an attitude is, well, when they start paying me more, I'll do more. And see, they got it backwards. No one is obligated to pay more money until you do more. But people are scared to death. A lot of them are, and they're never successful. That I may do a little bit more than what's in my due, and I'm not getting paid for it. If they'll do it first, they've got to have a belief that someone, or as Hill said, was, if you're doing job more than what you're being paid for, your employer will recognize it, or some other one will recognize it and steal you away. I never applied for a job after the first one. Someone always contacted me after 8 or 10 years on the job or something other than, and of course, I didn't always do it, but I was able to recognize opportunity. You know, the first job, $1.10 an hour, 55 cents for overtime because I was on a training program. I loved every minute of it because they gave me all these books to read and all this material I had to do and the correspondence. Of course, I wasn't getting paid to go to school. But then I told them, I'm going to be a bank president, you know. And it took me a while. You know, it took me a while. But I was 41 years old. But you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. But I could see it.
That comes back to Hill's definiteness of purpose. You had a goal, you set your mind out, and you worked it. And so, you know, from a standpoint of everybody listening, I want you to repeat. I want you to rewind and repeat and hear all of these nuggets because, you know, Napoleon Hill is the quintessential guide for playing big. He's, you know, his work is incredibly supportive because it's not just one man's philosophy. I mean, he interviewed 500 of the most wealthy people in the world. And so it's like the thesis of success. And yet the foundation continues to support that. And the people that serve the foundation live the principles. Nobody lives them more and demonstrates it more than Don Green.
Well, Sharon, you know, we grew up saying, people, you heard it saying, well, I'll believe it when I see it. See, they got it backwards. We have to see it first. We see ourselves in a better position. We see our book getting published before it ever happens. We have, even back to Job, he said, without a vision, my people perish. That means they have to see where they're going before they even get there. I mean, it's not that complicated. It's something other than that. It's like a magnet attracts you. If you've got a view of that thing, we think in pictures. And that's what a vision is. We're seeing in pictures of where we want to be. I said, I use it in school. I said, education or learn this material. It's simply a bridge to take us from where we are to where we want to be. Just that simple. That's all it is. It's a means to get from where we are to where we want to be. And without doing, having something or other, it's chances are we're going to remain in the same place because nobody's going to knock on your door and you sitting there on the sofa watching soap opera and say, boy, I got an opportunity for you today. You know, and I think some people are waiting on that, you know, they're waiting on that rather than, I use that quote, if your ship don't come in, why can't you swim out where it is? You know, we create our own opportunities most of the time by simply having a vision of what we want, where we want to be at.
Well, and on that note, I can't think of a better time for us. I hope that you'll come back and do another interview with us, Don, because that's what we're talking about. If your ship doesn't come in, swim out to it. And throughout this conversation, Don, one of the biggest principles we've talked about is that self-talk. What are you saying to yourself? Are you positioning yourself in the greatest place of potential and taking the action that's going to help you get to the next level? Because again, this podcast is all about the Play Big movement, and that is being number one in your field, living your legacy, and creating maximum impact. So I want to thank you, Don, again, for being with us today. And I want to thank all of you for watching this segment. Come back next week and see the next scheduled podcast.
Thank you. Sharon, I will describe you with one word. You're a jewel. Okay.
Thank you, Don. Love you very much.
You too. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to this segment of the Play Big Movement podcast. Please subscribe to iTunes and leave us a review, as well as join us in other areas of social media, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Sharon Lecter, and for Facebook, author Sharon Lecter. Thank you so much and have a fabulous day.